Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, August 28, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Teleforum conference call on the ongoing Dodd-Frank litigation. My name is Katie McClendon, and I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Gregory Jacob, who's a partner at O'Melveny & Myers. A more complete bio of our speaker is provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. With that, Mr. Jacob, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you all for joining us today to talk about the State National Bank of Big Spring case. As you probably are aware, we have received a decision last month from the D.C. Circuit, reversing a decision of the district court finding that we have no standing and allowing our suit to proceed on remand. So what I'm going to do today during this call is first I'm going to sort of recap how we got to the D.C. Circuit decision, comment on what the D.C. Circuit decision says and what its significance is, and then telegraph where we're going to be going with this litigation now that we finally have the opportunity to challenge the constitutionality of the CFPB, as well as the recess appointment of CFPB Director Richard Cordray and their constitutionality. So the original complaint in this case was filed back in June of 2012. If you're counting, that means that it took us more than 3 years to get to the point where we are actually going to be proceeding in the district court on the merits of the case. The original complaint challenged the constitutionality of both the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, and the Financial Stability Oversight Council, FSOC. That complaint was filed by me on behalf of my three clients, the State National Bank of Big Spring, which is a community bank in Big Spring, Texas, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI, and the 60 Plus Association. We amended that complaint in September of 2012, primarily to add in a related but separate challenge by three states, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Michigan, to the constitutionality of the Orderly Liquidation Authority under Dodd-Frank. That's Title II of the Dodd-Frank Act. The complaint was then amended again in February of 2013 to add an additional eight states in their challenge to the Orderly Liquidation Authority. And just in case callers are keeping track of who the most patriotic states are, the 11 states that were included in the complaint at the end were Alabama, Kansas, Georgia, Michigan, Montana, Nebraska, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Texas, and West Virginia. The government filed a motion to dismiss that complaint, alleging that none of us had standing. And I should just note, for purposes of this, the states represented themselves in this litigation. Patrick Weirich, the Solicitor General of Oklahoma, argued the standing issues for them, and each of the states had their own counsel on the briefing. My representation was limited to State National Bank of Big Spring, CEI, and the 60 Plus Association. The government argued that none of my three clients had standing to challenge the CFPB or the FSOC, and the states didn't have standing to challenge the Orderly Liquidation Authority. The basic sketch of the arguments on standing were as follows. We primarily hinged the standing of the private plaintiffs with respect to the CFPB and the FSOC on the bank had the simplest case. Certainly, everybody is affected by the CFPB and the FSOC and the costs that they impose on consumers everywhere. Both CEI and 60 Plus were affected by those, but State National Bank of Big Spring had an even clearer case of being affected by both of those institutions because it is a regulated entity by the CFPB. And it was affected by numerous regulations that the CFPB had published. For example, the CFPB issued what's known as the remittance rule. Remittances, of course, are transfers of money. Foreign remittances transfer it to foreign countries, and this remittance rule imposed all kinds of requirements on the kind of information that had to be provided to customers in order to send a remittance. Well, those costs for remittance transfers were just prohibitive for a small community bank like the State National Bank of Big Spring, which had historically used those remittances for the benefit of its customers in numerous circumstances. For example, a client got mugged in France. They needed a transfer of money over there to support things. The bank had been able to do that. But with the additional costs imposed by the remittance rule, they had to get out of doing remittances altogether. That picture got a little bit complicated because the president of the bank, Jim Purcell, testified before Congress. The plight of the bank came to Congress's attention because of our lawsuit. He was invited to testify in a hearing in the House of Representatives. And shortly after that hearing, the CFPB, coincidence, you tell me, amended the rule so that the bank has historically done about 70 remittance transfers a year. When the rule was first published, it was published saying if you do more than 50 a year, you're subject to the rules. Right after he testified, they raised that threshold to 100. And there had been no years in which the bank had in the past exceeded 100 remittance transfers. This looked to us certainly like a deliberate ploy to try to deprive us of standing. One of the things that we argued was, well, even though that safe harbor says that as long as we don't have more than 100, we're not subject to the rule. You know, 70 is close enough to 100 that we're going to have to count these remittances. How many do we do each year? And that's going to take some expenditure of resources just to devote somebody to each year counting them up and seeing whether we're going to be subject to the rule in the following year. There are also a number of other rules that the CFPB published that affected the bank in a variety of ways. There was a mortgage foreclosure rule that limited the circumstances under which the bank was allowed to proceed against somebody in foreclosure and did not allow it to take advantage of the simplified Texas foreclosure process that had previously been available to it. In fact, the bank, as a small community bank, had done an excellent job over the past 10 years of working with its customers to avoid defaults and had never had to actually foreclose against somebody, one of the points that the government made. But the bank was able to declare that these procedures that it previously had available to it under Texas law had actually helped it have leverage against customers at times, and it helped it secure compliance with customer mortgage obligations. And now it wasn't able to use that leverage anymore, and so it was harmed by that as well, without regard to whether there had been defaults in the past. Certainly there could be a default in the future that would affect it as well. And then there were a number of other regulations governing the conditions under which mortgages were required to be issued that were so onerous that they essentially forced the bank out of the mortgage market altogether. The government argued that the exit from the market was a self-inflicted wound, essentially. We didn't have to get out of the market. We could have stayed in and subjected ourselves to all of the potential liability that flowed from those rules. And just in the most general terms, those rules essentially subjected the bank to significantly more litigation risk. Given the kinds of loans that it was making at the community bank in the past, frequently, you know, giving people mortgages under circumstances where it knew, based on the character of the client, personal relationships over a long developed over a long period of time, that this was a creditworthy risk, even though on paper some of the parameters for that loan, you know, might have caused a less personally involved bank, one of the big boys, from making the loan. Well, the regulations effectively made those kinds of loans incredibly risky for the bank to participate in, subjected it to potential litigation risk, and so it exited the market. The other point of standing for the bank in all of this is because of the avalanche of regulations that came out of the CFPB, and I should note that this small sample of regulations that I've mentioned, the CFPB would issue a proposed rule, then they would issue an amendment to the proposed rule, then they would issue a stay of the proposed rule until such time as they had a chance to study the issues, then they would issue another version of the proposed rule. Well, the bank had to pay attention to all of these different versions and understand what each of them was going to require of it. You can't wait until the date that a regulation becomes effective and then start figuring out whether or not it applies to you. By that point, you may well be in breach of it. And so the bank subscribed to a service called the Compliance Alliance. It cost it $10,000 a year, but that service helped break down what the impact of these regulations was, figure out whether or not you were subject to it. But that was real money that the bank did not have to spend before the CFPB came around and did have to spend after the CFPB came around. The government argued that none of that was relevant. These compliance costs, it argued that the CFPB doesn't directly enforce these regulations against the bank because its deposit size is not large enough to meet the CFPB threshold. Yes, the bank is subject to those regulations, but its prudential regulator is the Office of the Comptroller of Currency. We could never quite figure out why it would be the case where we certainly were subject to the regulations promulgated by the CFPB, why it mattered who it was that enforced them against us when it was the CFPB's regulation that harmed us. The D.C. Circuit ultimately confirmed that we were right on that point. But the government sort of mocked us, arguing that we were spending all of this money on the Compliance Alliance to figure out that the CFPB doesn't, in fact, regulate us at all, and that expenditure couldn't possibly give rise to standing. With respect to the Financial Stability Oversight Council, the FSOC is a creature that is related to the whole too-big-to-fail question. The function of the FSOC is to designate entities other than those automatically designated by Dodd-Frank as being essentially too-big-to-fail. The FSOC's job is to designate other non-bank entities that may also be, in the judgment of the government, too big to fail. Now, there was no chance that a small community bank like State National Bank of Big Spring was ever actually going to be designated by the FSOC. And so what comes along with the designation of being too big to fail is, one, you become subject to all kinds of additional strenuous regulations that are onerous and that certainly would cost any entity subject to them. On the other hand, so that's the cost of being designated. But there's also substantial evidence, including statements by Ben Bernanke, head of the Federal Reserve at the time, that the effect of the government saying that you as an entity are too big to fail is that investors and creditors suddenly look at you as an entity as being less of a risk to invest in because they know that the government isn't going to let you fail. And so if they invest money in you, they don't bear all of the market risks that would apply to an entity that the government wasn't going to step in and rescue. And the result of this is that these too-big-to-fail entities designated by the FSOC get a cost of capital advantage over smaller entities like State National Bank of Big Spring. And so our in competing with them in those markets for raising capital, we were disadvantaged by the fact that these other entities were deemed too big to fail. The government argued that since we weren't subject to the regulation of the FSOC, we were too small ever to do so, that this subsidy that we argued existed was essentially irrelevant, that you couldn't get standing that way. Finally, with respect to the orderly liquidation authority, the states argued the orderly liquidation authority is an entity that exists and allows, in summary, allows the government through the Treasury Secretary and a couple of other entities in the financial services regulatory apparatus to essentially designate companies or banks or other too-big-to-fail type entities that have not yet filed for bankruptcy and are not yet insolvent as being at risk of insolvency. And when they do so, they're allowed to step in and liquidate that entity. These proceedings all take place in secret. The entity that's being liquidated is notified of the fact that they are about to be liquidated, but no other entity is allowed to be informed about the fact that the liquidation is going to occur. An entity about to be liquidated is given by the Act 24 hours to go to a federal district court and get an order from that district court that the judgment of the Treasury Secretary is incorrect and should be overturned. And if the district court doesn't, within 24 hours, overturn the decision of the Treasury Secretary, the liquidation proceeds. And it should be noted, the district court is not allowed under the terms of the Dodd-Frank Act to say, oh, by the way, you know, the Treasury Secretary has been examining this question in reams of documents for months now. I would like a little more time to make a decision. I need a little more time. Not allowed to do that. If the district court isn't able to reach a judgment that the judgment of the Treasury Secretary was wrong within that window, then by operation of law under the Dodd-Frank Act, the liquidation goes ahead and proceeds. The states were investors through their pension funds, as well as in some instances through other funds, in entities that were in the category that could be subject to liquidation. And as such, they would, in the event that a liquidation were to occur in the future, they would have no prior notice and no ability to participate in the proceedings that would affect their investments. And the states argued that the effect of allowing this secret proceeding to occur was that they were never going to be able to step in and challenge the constitutionality of those proceedings until it was too late, until the liquidation had already occurred. And as we saw previously with Chrysler and the state of Indiana and their investment in that, Indiana tried to challenge the constitutionality of the way that the Chrysler assets were allocated in the final settlement there and was told, sorry, it's too late. They've already been allocated. You no longer have standing. It's moot at this point. And effectively that the states would find themselves in that same position. Moreover, the Dodd-Frank Act overturns hundreds of years, essentially, of bankruptcy law requiring that similarly situated creditors be treated similarly in a liquidation. So if you have the same priority interest, everybody's supposed to recover the same. The Dodd-Frank Act undoes that. If an orderly liquidation occurs, the executive gets to determine who the winners and the losers are among those who were invested in the entity. And as we saw again in the example of Chrysler in Indiana, there the state was a big loser. Big winner, the unions who were invested in it. And that is the sort of thing, the sort of treatment that the states feared that they could expect. And the primary argument of the states with respect to their standing was the day before Dodd-Frank passed, we had certain rights guaranteed to us in bankruptcy, this right to equal treatment. The Dodd-Frank Act stripped that away from us. If you think of property rights as a bundle of sticks, we had this bundle of property rights the day that Dodd-Frank was passed, and it was taken away from us by the Dodd-Frank Act, that right to equal treatment. And that diminished the value of our investments. the value of your investments is in part based on your risk associated with those investments, and the deprivation of that stick, that guarantee of traditional bankruptcy rights, cost us value with respect to those assets. And that is a present loss. That doesn't depend upon some future liquidation. That is an additional loss of value that we have that we are suffering today. Those are the basic arguments that went before the district court. We drew Judge Ellen Huvel, a Clinton appointee, in the district court. Judge Huvel ended up dismissing all of the plaintiffs across the board, the entire complaint, and said these claims aren't ripe, these are facial constitutional challenges, nor do I think that any of you are actually injured today. She thought that the state's injuries were entirely speculative. She thought more or less the same thing with respect to our arguments about the Financial Stability Oversight Council and the competitive harm that we faced with respect to competitors in those capital markets. She just thought it was ridiculous, the notion that a small bank like the State National Bank of Big Spring competes with the big boys like GE Capital. She basically had no understanding of the most basic laws of economics in suggesting that, but that's what she said. And with respect to the CFPB, she said, yeah, you know, you got out of the mortgage market, so none of those injuries count. These other regulations, yeah, you know, I understand that you're having to monitor them. Maybe you're having to count remittances. But what she said during the argument, she didn't put this sentence in her final opinion, but what she said to me is, you know, these costs that you're talking to me about, Mr. Jacob, this $10,000 a year, you know, that's life. That's not standing. That's life. Well, we now know from the D.C. Circuit with respect to the CFPB, that's not life, Judge Huvel. That is, in fact, standing. What the D.C. Circuit said with respect to this is the bank, big surprise, the State National Bank is a regulated entity. It cited to the fact that we were counting remittance transfers, but I think that the key sentence from the D.C. Circuit's opinion is there is no doubt that the bank is regulated by the Bureau. Therefore, we have standing to challenge its constitutionality. That is an incredibly helpful statement. It certainly allows us to proceed against the CFPB. It's, I think, demonstrably correct that the bank has in fact suffered injury, but for the CFPB, it would not have had to pay these monies. It wouldn't have had to get out of these markets. But this is actually a very valuable opinion, I think, out of the D.C. Circuit going forward that clarifies the ability of regulated entities to challenge the constitutionality of their regulators. There were some suggestions in some cases like Sabre in the D.C. Circuit that this might be the case. Judge Huvel was very dismissive of this argument that any regulated entity essentially has the right to challenge the regulator. But that is now established, and hopefully can be a principle that will allow good governance going forward, where, you know, entities that are subject to regulations and thus clearly are bearing costs as a result of it without having to go through all of the interstitial details of those costs have the standing to challenge it. Unfortunately, actually, there was one other challenge that our standing was upheld on, and that is our ability to challenge the unconstitutional recess appointment of Richard Cordray. The unconstitutionality of that appointment is made indisputably clear by the Noel Canning decision from the Supreme Court. So there's not really a question as to whether he's constitutionally appointed or not. While he was recess appointed and before he was later confirmed, as you all may recall, the Senate finally did confirm him, and in so doing rendered him a constitutionally appointed director of the CFPB, to the extent that the CFPB is constitutional at all. But for a long time, he was serving in an unconstitutional capacity, and during that time, he signed many of these regulations that affect us. We now have standing to challenge the constitutionality of his appointment through the lens of those regulations. And so I'll be talking about that in a moment in terms of the next steps for our case. The D.C. Circuit determined that we did not have standing with respect to the FSOC, and that the states did not have standing with respect to the orderly liquidation authority. On the FSOC, the court essentially said, look, we understand that you're saying that there's a subsidy that's conferred on these too big to fail entities by additional regulations, but you're not able to point us to any case where we have said that you gain, that you as a competitor can gain standing based on your competitors being more heavily regulated than you are. And they just didn't think that that concept washes. I think that that has to be wrong on a certain level. If the regulations or if the statute clearly stated, okay, for too big to fail entities, we're going to give them, for their business purposes, $1 million a year, but we're also going to impose this additional regulation on it. And if that $1 million a year that they got to essentially just put into their treasury account made it harder for us to compete against them, I think that we should indeed have a competitive injury under those circumstances and be able to challenge them. If the regulation went hand in hand with something that gave them a competitive advantage, that should be enough to give us standing. Unfortunately, the panel here, now obviously the circumstances of the regulation at issue for us are less clear insofar as the statute doesn't directly confer on them a sum of money, but we presented very good evidence. In fact, sort of uniform authorities out there all essentially say if you're too big to fail, you get an implicit subsidy as a result of that. But it's not an explicit one, and it's not a direct grant from the government. And that's more or less, I think, where the law now stands on that question. I don't think that it's quite right the way that the court phrased it, but it's a unanimous decision on all issues. And with Judge Kavanaugh having signed on to it, we've made the judgment not to challenge that further in this litigation, at least. Finally, with respect to the states, the court essentially determined that this is too speculative an injury. It didn't think that the present diminution in the value of the assets that we argued for in terms of the loss of the present property right was sufficiently concrete to give rise to standing, and therefore didn't allow the states to move forward with their challenge, which is a real shame on a number of levels. It'll be very difficult for any entity to actually challenge the constitutionality of the orderly liquidation authority during a liquidation. It's essentially probably now unchallengeable. The court did drop a footnote in its opinion, noting that if the state plaintiffs are injured at some point in the future by a liquidation or reorganization under the government's orderly liquidation authority, they can seek to raise their constitutional arguments then. It's not clear that the structure of the OLA, orderly liquidation authority, actually presents an opportunity for that challenge, but the states did at least walk away with this statement from the D.C. Circuit that essentially they have to be allowed some kind of opportunity to present a challenge at that point in time. Whether that will actually hold up against a mootness argument, sorry, the liquidation's already complete, you can't argue this now, or the secrecy bar that will prevent them from directly even being aware of the fact that a liquidation is occurring until it's already gone, remains to be seen. I have yet to talk to anybody who thinks on the merits that the OLA can possibly be squared with the due process requirements of the Constitution. A 24-hour challenge in the district court with an automatic statement that if the district court doesn't overturn it within that window, it automatically proceeds. Just can't be squared with due process, but unfortunately the states who had the best bet of being able to raise those issues now aren't allowed to. So where does that leave us going forward? That leaves us now finally being able to get to the merits of our challenge to the CFPB and the recess appointment of Director Cordray. Let me talk about Cordray first. As I've noted, the unconstitutionality of his appointment is completely clear. The question is, what can we now do about that? Does it even matter since he's now been blessed by the Senate subsequently to his recess appointment? Well, he signed during the time of his unconstitutional appointment a number of regulations that continue to affect us and many other entities today. And the argument that we will be making to the court is that, you know, it would be one thing, let me take one step back here. What Director Cordray did after he was constitutionally appointed and the Senate constitutionally advised and consented to him, to that appointment, he published a statement in the Federal Register saying, oh, by the way, in case anybody is wondering, I hereby wave my CFPB fairy wand, and everything that I did while I was perhaps illegally appointed is exactly what I would have done had I been legally appointed. So it's all okay. I hereby bless it. The question is going to be, on remand, can that save these regulations that were signed off on by an unconstitutionally appointed authority, this fairy wand statement in the Federal Register? It's going to be our position that, you know, with respect to, for example, an opinion letter that could just be issued by the director at any point in time without the need for any kind of legally required process, could he retroactively bless that? Probably, because with respect to that, he can issue it today just like he could have issued it 3 years ago. So effectively, we can count it as though he was issuing it as of the date of the fairy wand blessing in the Federal Register. But with respect to rulemaking, there's actually a prescribed process by law that requires the sign-off of a constitutionally appointed officer. And these regulations didn't have that. You can't go back in time with this fairy wand CFPB blessing and change the fact that the person who signed it wasn't constitutionally appointed. And so we're going to be arguing that all of those regulations must be invalidated and cannot be applied to us on a going forward basis because of his unconstitutional appointment. Second, we now finally get to proceed to the merits of our argument with respect to the unconstitutionality of the CFPB, spelled out in that complaint filed more than 3 years ago. The record that the CFPB has compiled during that period of time, I should say, I think provide ample support for the arguments that we launched that this agency represents a massive separation of powers violation. It is unhinged from the checks and balances that we expect as part of our constitutional governance for agencies within the executive branch, and that it should be struck down and invalidated because of the absence of those checks and balances within its structure. The things that we specifically cite in our complaint are, first of all, that the director of the CFPB cannot be removed for policy reasons by the president. There's a statutory bar on his removal. So the director is insulated from control by the president. Despite the fact that the director is, within the structure of the CFPB, is a single official with complete and total authority to run all of the powers that are vested in the CFPB personally within their own discretion. That has to be a principal officer of the United States. There has to be the ability of the president to control such an officer. And it's particularly the case with the CFPB, where unlike most of the regulatory agencies that exist out there, where we have multi-member commissions, the NLRB, the EEOC, all of these entities function with multi-member, multi-party commissions that provide some internal checks and balances. None of that is present with respect to the CFPB. You don't have internal checks. It's all consolidated in one person and not subject to the control of the president. So there's no check coming from the head of the executive branch. There's also no check coming from Congress. Congress has expressly abdicated its authority to control this agency through Civics 101. How does Congress control or exercise control and oversight over the government that it funds? Well, through the power of the purse. The CFPB isn't funded by Congress. It's not funded by appropriations. Instead, it gets to designate a certain percentage of the Federal Reserve's budget that it just then takes for itself and can use that to fund the activities of the agency. In fact, Dodd-Frank specifies that the appropriations committees that would normally have oversight authority over through the power of the purse over the CFPB are not allowed to exercise that authority at all. Not only are they not allowed to appropriate for it because it gets its money through other means, they're not allowed to exercise any oversight over how the CFPB is spending its money. And what we've seen from the CFPB are massive overruns on building expenditures, paying higher salaries to government employees than anybody else throughout the federal government. Essentially, they cannibalize other agencies through their ability to offer higher salaries that aren't subject to the normal congressional controls, and essentially is an agency run amok with respect to its expenditures as well. So there's no executive control, there's no congressional control, and then add on top of that sweeping authority to define what constitutes, in its view, abusive conduct by the entities that it directly regulates. And in fact, it specifically is given statutory authority to the extent that it might share jurisdiction with other agencies over certain areas of regulatory responsibility that where they might have competing interpretations. By statute, the CFPB's interpretation is given ultimate authority over any other agency. And the courts are then required, of course, through Chevron and our administrative agency case law framework to defer to that interpretation. It'd be bad enough that the agency has this authority to define what it thinks to be abusive conduct and then go prosecute it. The agency has announced through Cordray, yeah, you know what, that's a good question what that term means. We're not going to define it. Instead, we're just going to bring cases and we'll let our cases speak for themselves. It'll just be on an ad hoc basis that we essentially are going to define these terms. And that is the kind of conduct we've seen out of the CFPB. So what we have in the CFPB is sweeping power to proceed with prosecutions with this ad hoc interpretive authority on terms that are completely unclear what it means, not subject to control by the executive and not subject to control by Congress, and with only limited supervision by the judiciary because of these sweeping powers that are vested in it. Now, each of these things individually, each of these problems individually, if they just existed individually in an agency, might well be blessed by the courts. But where all of these things are combined in a single agency, our complaint argues correctly that the mosaic of all of those things renders this agency unconstitutional. It does not have sufficient checks and balances, and it should be invalidated. So that's where we're headed, back to the D.C. Circuit. We expect the mandate to issue, or not to the D.C. Circuit, the D.C. District Court. We expect the mandate to issue from the D.C. Circuit shortly, and then we'll be back before Judge Huvel, where we had such a warm reception before. I'm sure we'll get a similarly warm reception on remand, and I will do my best to refrain from specifically commenting to the judge, well, you know, evidently, Judge Huvel, that wasn't life. That was, in fact, standing. So we're glad to be back before you here. But we look forward to beginning to spar with the government on the actual merits of this monster that Congress has created. And with that very long sketch of the history of the case and where things are headed, I guess we now open things for questions.
Yeah, let's go to some questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say, your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. We'll be answering questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. Well, while we're waiting to see if anybody comes up with a question, I'll announce an upcoming Teleforum conference call. It's going to be on Monday, August 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And we'll host a conversation with Michael Lotito of the Workplace Policy Institute about a significant new ruling by the National Labor Relations Board. Please consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federal Society's website. And please visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you might have missed. We'll go to our first question.
It seems to me that what little you got out of this appeals court is still a tremendous amount, considering the huge amount of deference that the courts have given regulatory bodies in the past. And do you think this has hopeful indications for people challenging agencies in the future, other agencies than the one set up by Dodd-Frank?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I do think that this is actually a significant precedential opinion concerning how standing to challenge a regulatory authority will be handled in the D.C. Circuit going forward, which, of course, is the most important circuit on those issues, and that if you are regulated, if you are a regulated entity, that the court's not going to entertain a bunch of quibbling over, you know, should you have spent $10,000 on Compliance Alliance or would $1,000 have been more reasonable? The court made clear that even having to appoint somebody within the bank to once a year go through and count remittance transfers, or I shouldn't say once a year, they have to be kept track of throughout the course of the year. But that's not, you know, an overwhelming responsibility, but it is a real cost to the bank, and that is good enough. And so, yes, I do think that this should make it easier for regulated entities to challenge the regulatory state going forward. They won't have to jump through all of the hurdles that we did here. If this opinion had been on the books prior to our going to Judge Huvel, I think it's fair to say we wouldn't have had to go through this exercise that we've had for the last 2 years. This opinion really clarifies the D.C. Circuit law. Just one other thing I wanted to back up. This is not responsive to the question, but I had talked about the states representing themselves. I did want to make clear that I was not the only attorney representing the private parties in this case. Adam White and Boyden Gray of Boyden Gray and Associates were key attorneys also taking part in that representation. Sam Kasman of CEI represented CEI and is on the briefs in the litigation, and Kate Tarbert of O'Melveny played a key role in the briefing as well.
Well, Mr. Jacob, if you have anything else to add, then please do so. And otherwise, I'll go ahead and close us out.
I think that's it. Just thank you for everybody who joined the call, and we're looking forward to finally getting to the business of trying to slay the beast here.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Gregory Jacob for joining us today, and thank you also to our audience. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. And please do join us for our next teleforum on Monday, August 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.